Hi, I'm Brett Johnson, former United States Most Wanted cyber criminal, now good guy, and host of The Brett Johnson Show. Hey, look, today's episode is episode number 72. It's a prison politics test pilot featuring Tom Hughes. So here's the deal. Most people who listen to my show may know that I'm in the process of trying to get off the ground this prison politics show where I bring in former felons and we talk about the prison experience and how that prison experience may or may not have changed their views of societal and political issues post-release in the real world, so to speak. That being said, hey, this show, it's a fluid show, and I'm still trying to iron out the bugs of it, trying to figure out what the show is going to become, listening to feedback. And what I wanted to do before I actually launched the show, I wanted to make sure all the bugs were ironed out or as close as I possibly could get to this. So what I'm going to do is I'm incorporating the prison politics program into the Brett Johnson Show. Every week, every 2 weeks, we'll have a prison politics show that is under just the Brett Johnson umbrella. You'll see the prison politics logo pop up, all that kind of stuff. So this first show is just a test pilot. I'm bringing in Mr. Tom Hughes. I've got a great deal of respect for him. He's a very humble individual. He's a fraudster, a former fraudster, who has turned his life around. And just to let you know who Tom is, we're going to go to his page right now. So this is Tom Hughes, and he says that his website is hireathief.com. He's a speaker on fraud, the ministry, and professional responsibility. And there you see Tom. He's rocking the bow tie. And so who is Tom? So he says, at one time or another, I've been an accountant, a banker, a manager for touring musicians, and a small business CFO. He's consulted with small companies that couldn't keep up with their growth, and he's consulted with small businesses who have had to reorganize in order to stay alive. He is also, as he says, he's a disgraced former accountant who has been to prison and back for fraud, not once, but twice. Because much like myself, I guess Tom just didn't get the message the first time around. Sometimes it's a learning process. It is not. For some people, the first time around does not do it. And that was the story with Tom as well. So Tom sits down on the Brett Johnson Show for a test pilot of the prison politics program that we're trying to get off the ground. Here's the deal. Let me know what you think about it. Let me know what you like, what you don't like. This specific episode does not really go into politics a lot. We go into Tom's prison experience. So what he thought of that, how he turned his life around. And that's going to happen sometimes on the Prison Politics Show. Let me know, as I said, what you like, what you don't like. If you comment about it, I do take that feedback seriously. Some of the feedback I'll go ahead and implement. Some of it I won't. But please let me know what you think, what works and what doesn't. Subscribe to the show if you like it. Subscribe to the show if you don't like it. Because believe you me, I can use the numbers. I'm trying to get this show and the Prison Politics Show to the point where it's generating some money for yours truly, because believe you me, I like money, I need money, I want money, so please subscribe. Without further ado, let's go ahead and start episode 72 of The Brett Johnson Show, a prison politics test pilot with Tom Hughes. Enjoy. So you'll see the sign is up. It literally just got put up.
I see that.
So everything's going all right with you?
It is. It really is.
Good. Well, look, I cannot thank you enough for agreeing to come on the show. Truly. If you can't tell, I'm just trying to get this thing going.
Yeah.
So I've got an idea for this show. It's called Prison Politics.
Okay.
And the idea, and you know, ideas change, and to be honest with you, it's already changed to an extent. But the idea is talking to people who have served time,
mm-hmm.
to talk about the politics of prison, and okay. also how their prison experience may or may not have influenced the way they view the world post release.
Okay,
so that's the idea. And to be honest with you, the idea comes because I was talking to Matt Cox. I don't know if you know this guy or not.
I've seen him in the commercials. I see him on LinkedIn. I've never spoken right. with.
So Matt is a former mortgage fraudster, and he runs. Go ahead.
He's the nobody's going to call you guy.
That's the guy. So Matt was he runs the True Crime Channel over on YouTube. I've been on his show a couple of times, and he and I are friends. He's been out a few years, but you know, he was U.S. Most Wanted too. And so he calls me one morning, and he's trying to get into the speaking circuit, and he's doing a fair job with that. And he was asking for my advice. He was asking, you know, what should he charge? Who should he speak for? Could I help him? I was like, absolutely, man. Then he tells me, he's like, hey, man, you need to be talking to criminals. And I was like, Matt, I don't want to talk to criminals. And he was like, well, that's where you make some money. And I was like, well, hell. So, the thing is, Tom, you know, I love the hell out of you. I really do. I think that you're outstanding.
I appreciate that.
But you know, and you probably know this too, a lot of people who have served prison time, they still have a lot of cognitive dissonance. You know, they're either angry or they think that, you know, I broke the law because I had to, something like that. And I don't want to hear those stories. I don't. So the idea that I came up with is, you know, hey, we'll talk about politics, because everyone likes to complain about politics. We'll talk about how people survived prison and what that experience was. And, you know, you can talk about your story a little bit at the beginning. So that's the idea. And I'm sure that it will change as time goes on. So that being said, since this is basically the first episode of Prison Politics, if you don't mind, why don't you tell the audience who you are?
Okay. As you've already pointed out, my name is Tom. For a long time, I called myself an accountant. I was a college dropout who found myself in accounting and finance positions, largely due to polite demeanor and a winning smile. I've never been licensed as a CPA. I didn't graduate from college till after I was 50.
Okay.
What I like to point out is that I was not an embezzler. I was not a scamster. I wasn't a fraudster. I was a thief. Embezzlement kind of creates an impression of intelligence or pre-planning or anything like that. My crimes, for the most part, were never more sophisticated than I'm paying my client's phone bill.
Right.
Wait, I have a phone bill too. I think I'll pay both bills. For better or worse, that's what we think of when we talk about fraud and embezzlement. That's usually what we're talking about in smaller organizations, is that somebody sees stuff and takes it. And I usually talk about internal controls as your only line of defense against that, because you have stuff and people want it. So that's what I did. I got bagged for it due to a bank error, which was beyond my control.
Right.
And I caught probation, home confinement, restitution, and community service. And I walked out of that courtroom thinking, I got away with this.
Right.
I'm not going to serve a day in jail. And I took probation completely unseriously, violated repeatedly, and it ended up in federal prison, not for the crimes I committed, but for failing probation.
Which, hey, I've been there too. Of course, I served prison time and I violated probation too. So if you don't mind my asking, what were you doing that violated probation?
As anyone who's been on probation knows, that you have a set of conditions.
Right.
The one single most important condition of probation, above mandatory drug testing, above you better not leave the state, above you have to get a job, number one condition, don't commit any more crimes. I did it to another client who knew I was on probation and kept me as their bookkeeper.
Okay.
And I did it to them.
Let me ask you, Tom, why? So you'd go, and hey, I've been there, done that too. But in your circumstance, so you had pled out. I assume you pled, you didn't take it to trial, right?
Oh yeah.
Okay. So you pled out, you got probation. So, I mean, you got off really well there.
Oh, but I got a sweet deal in probation.
But you still decided to go ahead and continue committing crime. Now, why was that? And here's what I want to know. Mm-hmm. I want to know, back then, there was a reason why you told yourself you did it. And then there's the real reason. So if I could get both of those, I'd appreciate it.
I have always regarded myself the smartest guy in the room. It's not lost on me that the title of one of the books about Enron is The Smartest Guys in the Room. I just figured I can do this and I'm going to get away with it. Or I just compartmentalized things well enough that I didn't consider what was going to happen later on.
Right.
I figured I'm going to do this. You know what? If I get bagged for what I did last week, it's not going to matter what I do this week. So it's kind of fatalistic, but my self-delusion was pretty powerful too. I just assumed that I was going to start making winning trades. I just assumed that I was going to accumulate more clients and make more money. I just assumed that nobody was going to notice. Mainly because of my own desire to do what I was doing.
Right. How long did you commit crime before you first got caught and got the probation?
I got caught a few times.
Okay.
And my parents bailed me out because I went to them crying, saying, I'm never going to do this again and I don't want to go to jail.
Right.
And I broke their hearts repeatedly. And I, what's the word I'm looking for? I hurt their financial strength. That's the word I'm looking for.
Right.
I compromised their retirement years because they went into retirement with less money saved than they should have, because they kept bailing me out. And I had it in the back of my head after the first time, if I do this again, they'll probably bail me out again. Until the time I actually got caught and my client called the cops, who called the bank, who called the controller of the currency, who called the FBI. And there was no stopping it at that point.
Right. So you got probation on that. When you violated probation, how much time did you actually serve behind the fence?
I caught 9 months of federal time.
Okay.
And then while I was locked up, I wrote to a client of mine back home and said, you don't know this yet, but you're going to figure it out when it's time to do your tax return, which, by the way, I can't do for you this year. But I stole money from you last year. So when I got out, I faced a state charge for taking their money and did just under 6 months of state time the following year.
Okay. All right. I guess, you know, you told me about your parents. Are your parents still around or not?
No.
Were your parents able to see you turn your life around?
My parents both told me that they were more proud of me doing what I do today than at any time in my life.
That I like that. I do, at least.
And when they had to move from my childhood home into assisted living, they basically turned over their financial lives to me so that I could manage them carefully. So assisted living did eventually wipe them out.
Right.
But they didn't go without for as long as they were alive.
I've got my father right now. He's living with me. He's been living with us for, almost a year now. And he's getting to the point. I mean, he's been to the point where he really needs to go into assisted living. The problem is, as you just pointed out, assisted living wipes you out. So he's got a home that he's got a lot of equity in. We've got that up for sale. Mm-hmm. And trying to get that thing sold so he can go into assisted living, because we're already at the point that, you know, we really just cannot take care of him in the house anymore. So I'm hoping, the hope right now is that once the house is sold, that will give enough money to put him into assisted living for 2 years. I don't think that he'll, I honestly doubt he qualifies for assisted living right now, but the hope is that it pays for 2 years, at which point somewhere through there, I don't think that, he can handle assisted living anymore. And then he goes into a veteran's home, which evidently, I'm in Alabama. Mm-hmm. Evidently the veteran's homes here are very nice. So okay. That's the hope. I told the man, he asked me about a year and a half ago. He was like, will you, I'm at the point I can't call the shots anymore. Can you, make sure I'm going to be okay? And I told him, I was like, yeah, I'll do that. You know, I found out that, you know, my story, Tom, I mean, that's, I'd always painted my dad as the guy who was the good guy that he just kind of forgot he was. And Now that he's been living with me, I found out, well, he was just the guy that really didn't care a lot of the time about the abuse that me and my sister were going through and all that, which is kind of a wake-up call.
Okay.
But, you know, it's one of those things where I keep referring to that old statement of ignorance is bliss where wisdom is folly, that it's better to know than not. I wouldn't want to live in, you know, some sort of self-deception or self-denial, telling myself that something that was untrue. So it's, mm-hmm. it's better that I know, but I tell you, man, it's a hell of a wake-up call. I guess one of the things I'd like to ask you, so you ended up first in federal prison, and there's, so you've been in federal and state, and as you know, there's a heck of a difference between the two. So when you got to federal prison, what was the idea you had of prison before you walked in? And once you got there, how did that change?
My brother was kind enough to drive to where I was living in northern Vermont and give me a ride to prison in Massachusetts. Okay. So we had this long talk on the way down there. And he was telling me how cool my life had been. He said, you know, I haven't been half the places you've been. I've never been to the Grammys. I've never done this or that. And it only then did it start to occur to me that the stuff I thought was so cool maybe wasn't especially so cool given where we were headed that day.
Right.
Even then, I wasn't taking the whole thing seriously. I had it in my head that I was going to walk up to the front desk in that prison, drop my driver's license and my American Express card on the counter, and tell them I wanted a room on a low floor away from the ice machine. One look at the two characters behind that desk when I walked in told me they had heard that before, and it wasn't funny that time either.
It was not their first rodeo.
Not only that, but the American Express card I was carrying was under a stolen identity anyway. Well, I was feeling put upon because, you know, my time in federal prison amounted to about a day for every $1.85 that I had stolen in my violation. I conveniently left out the actual crime that I got sentenced for. It took me about 3 days locked up to understand, yes, I did this, and there's a reason I'm here.
Right.
A lot of guys had been there a lot longer than I was, and never figured that out. I had plenty of guys around me who I knew were going back to prison sometime, just as soon as they could get out, because they didn't get it. And I think I was blessed to understand very early on that this was an opportunity for me.
So with you, it was just a matter of days that you came to this realization.
In a different interview, I would talk about, I firmly believe I was called to ministry my first night in prison.
I mean, you can talk about that. I mean, hey, this show is about that prison experience and coming to terms and how it influenced some things. So when you say that, what do you mean? What happened?
So back up about 6 months before I got locked up, and I had this moment where I realized my life was spinning out of control, and it was because I had completely lost sight of my faith. And I did a lot of renewing, and I got involved with my church in the youth music group. And right after the first meeting of the youth music group, I learned I was getting locked up. So I went to our associate pastor and said, why would this happen now that I'm kind of back on my feet in my faith? Why would, you know, I end up disappointing the kids in the church? And the pastor said, you know what? All the kids in the church have one thing in common. They already go to church. You're headed somewhere where this is going to be important for you. You weren't renewed in your faith for the kids in our church. You were renewed in your faith for this. So my first night in prison, I'm sitting there in the dark in SHU, or the box or the hole, depending right. on which facility you're in. And I had just gotten this.
You still got your prison ID.
I'm pretty sure you weren't supposed to take that with you, but they didn't search me all that well.
I had mine for a few years.
Okay. So I'm sitting there in the dark and I decide, you know, I don't have my phone on my hip and I don't have anything to read. I don't have the one book I thought I was allowed to bring. I got nothing.
Right.
And I start to pray. Because after all, praying is what we do when there's absolutely, positively nothing conceivable else that we could do.
Right.
And this voice in my heart says, "So, what you doing?" And I'm like, "Nothing." And the voice says, "You know, now that you're here, I'm wondering, maybe every once in a while, if you find the time in the right moment, maybe, possibly, you might talk about me to somebody." And I'm like, "Whoa, whoa, that's so much pressure. I'm not your guy. I'm not an evangelist. I'm not anything of the sort. Nope, not me. Not me." And the voice says, "Would you think about it?" And I'm like, "Absolutely not. Yeah, don't you know what I've done?" Duh. Yes, he knows what I've done. I threw everything away. I threw away a marriage, a home, a professional practice. It's all gone. And the voice says, "Ever heard of Moses?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I've heard of Moses. Moses killed a man and took off running for 40 years. You know what he left behind? He left behind ascension to the throne of Egypt, most powerful man on the planet. Were you planning on being most powerful man on the planet, Tom?" "No, because that's what Moses threw away. Now stop 50 people on the street and ask them to name a pharaoh of Egypt. King Tut doesn't count. And then ask who's heard of Moses. Don't tell me what you've thrown away." Now, I knew in my heart that this was a conversation with God.
Right.
Mainly because if I was making up both sides of this conversation, I would have been able to get out of it. That's when I knew that's the mission field I was in.
So let me ask you, you I was obviously brought up in the church.
Yep.
Or no. So here's the thing. As you know, because you did serve enough time to see this, a lot of people, when they get in trouble, they find Jesus behind the fence. And then when they're released, they leave Jesus behind the fence.
Absolutely.
You were not that guy.
When I preach in prison, which I've done occasionally, I make absolutely clear that if you don't have your butt in a church the Sunday morning after you get out, you're not going back.
Right.
But, you know, prison's an artificial environment.
Right.
You look up after 6 months in prison and say, "Boy, I haven't bought a bag of dope in 6 months." Because all of the addictions and triggers and horrible things in your life, you just left in a pile outside the front door. You don't need the things in your life that you were leaning on before. You don't have a boss ordering you around. You don't have a wife nagging you. You don't have financial pressure. You don't have a landlord. You don't have any responsibility at all. Of course you don't need to buy drugs.
Right.
Of course you don't need to download porn. You're completely stripped of responsibility. Now the hope is that you can build up that responsibility little by little. Little things like you have to make your bunk every morning. You have to stand for count. Yeah. Embarrassingly small things to right. build up your sense of responsibility. But once you get out, and you've got a boss and a girlfriend and a landlord, your addictions are right where you left them. Your bad habits are right where you left them. That's why it's important to have your butt in a seat in church the first Sunday you get out.
I mean, that's a really good point that you make there. And I honestly, I couldn't have put it like that myself. This idea that you leave those things that you could not be responsible for, at the gate, and you go in, and they basically start you with the, you know, that step by step program. Can you first get up out of the bunk?
Yeah.
Can you make the bunk? Can you clean your cell or your area? And can you keep that prison job, since you're in federal prison, can you keep that prison job at, you know, 9 to 12 cents an hour? Can you do this? And that, you're right. I mean, this is one of these processes of teaching you to be responsible for your life. And they figure that, hey, if you can just start with the small things, if you can just do the smallest thing,
yeah,
maybe you can get to the point where you're more responsible once you step outside of the fence. That's an excellent, that is something, I got to be honest, I had never thought of it like that.
But not to mention the fact that if you're in a camp, it's a privilege.
It is.
In my camp, no fence, no bars. Some nights I'm pretty sure there was no CO.
Right.
Well, if you screw up in a camp, there's no arrest, there's no indictment, there's no investigation. The real prison is up there on the hill.
Right.
If you do something, that's where you're going this afternoon. You know, the connection between behavior and consequence is amplified and shortened considerably. If I do this, this will happen.
Right.
So yes, I will make my bunk in the morning. Yes, I will stand for count. Yes, I will, you know, I will not wear my shower shoes into the dining room at lunch. Just the most basic things. And that allows you to build, if you'll take the chance, build some sense of responsibility.
So let me ask you, and I'm assuming, so you said you spent the first night in the shoe, for those who don't know, and your institution may have been a little bit different. In Texas, if you did not get to the compound in time that day, you did not hit general population. They kept you in holding for that night until the next morning when you'd enter general pop. So I assume that's what happened. Was that first night or no?
Their standard procedure was, if you self-surrender, you need to spend three nights in SHU or two nights in SHU to be sure you don't have TB.
Okay. Okay.
Which struck me as really odd, because they also said, if you're taken directly into custody, you don't have to wait and shoot. So if you drag me kicking and screaming out of a courtroom, I guess I can't possibly have TB.
Exactly. Why would you?
Right. So I did read a lot of the program statements and policies before I got locked up.
Okay.
I had, so obviously I was an expert when I got there. Smartest guy.
As everyone is.
Oh, good heavens. Yes. Yeah, good time. So I ended up two nights in the box, and then they took me out of my cell and said, okay, walk down to the camp. It's like a half, three quarters of a mile walk out the front door of the institution down to the camp. And I'm looking around like, so you're telling me just to walk out of here? And they said, yeah, they're expecting you. Okay. That was weird for me. You know, I was not prepared for how seemingly lax and absurd some of the security measures were.
Right.
But I got used to it. You know that door in the supermarket that says alarm will sound if you open this door?
Right.
In a prison, they really mean it. But I settled right in. First thing I realized, in my camp, in my half of the unit, I was among the youngest, least educated, least accomplished men there. The amount of education and experience and raw talent in a federal camp, it breaks my heart to think that all that talent is sitting there unused.
Right. So you go in, who meets you? Other than the guard, I know the guards are going to meet you. But who meets you when you get in?
There was a guard there, but he really wasn't all that involved.
Okay.
I wouldn't call the guy I'm thinking of, he really didn't have an official position, aside from he was the guy that passed out the rolls of toilet paper every Friday.
Okay.
But he was kind of outgoing, gregarious. He was in for political corruption. And he just kind of looked to make sure everybody was doing okay. Genuinely nice. And, you know, took me around, introduced me. The CEO did give me one assignment for a bunk. Nice union boss from Jersey whose name ended with a vowel. And then 15 minutes later, they said, nope, never mind. Pick me up, move me somewhere else. But I was sitting on my bunk the first 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And there's a kid on his bunk across the hallway from me. And he's reading Bible. And now at this point, I'm thinking, if there's a group here, I guess I can just get involved. So I asked the kid, so is there any kind of prayer group or Christian group here? Is there a guitar around? The kid says, well, there was. A guy named Medina, he was Spanish, so he moved pretty easily between the white guys and the Spanish guys, knew his Bible really well, preached every Sunday, fairly decent guitar player, knew a lot of songs. He was really good, ran a Christian group. Yeah, we miss him. You got his bunk. So, yeah, that's why I'm here. But it was fairly stress-free. I had one guy approach me the first day and say, hey, you know, I'll do your laundry for $25 a month.
Right. Which is common.
I didn't know the value of $25 a month.
Right.
And I was certainly used to doing my own laundry. But other than that, everyone was just kind of cool and bored.
Okay. So in the 9 months, no real trouble, no altercations of any type, anything like that.
I had some altercations in state prison, but
I figured you would.
Yeah. But that
it's a
was
a different environment.
That was over quickly.
Okay.
We can talk about that later.
No, absolutely. So the nine, did you start because you had this experience in the shoe?
Mm-hmm.
Did you start almost as soon as you got to general population with talking to people about Jesus, God, the ministry, and starting these conversations at that point? Did it take a while to get into that or what?
I got locked up on a Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up in the camp on Thursday.
Okay.
Commissary orders were the following Monday with delivery, I think, the following Tuesday. So I was going to go the better part of 10 days or so without anything other than the imported soap and horrible toothpaste they had given me and the socks and underwear and green uniform that I had on.
Right.
And nothing else. I had no property, no nothing. And a couple of guys gave me, you know, a spare pair of socks, things like that. And I was really grateful. As soon as I got cash on my books, and as soon as I could order commissary, I started ordering extra soap and an additional toothbrush, because guys would come in on a regular basis, like me, or guys coming from another institution whose property was 10 days behind them, and they'd be in exactly the situation I was. So I started tying up little bags, and when a new guy came in, I'd say, here you go. You know, I don't want anything in return. If you want to buy something extra for the next guy, that'd be great. But I'm not going to tell you to, because this is absolutely against the rules.
Right.
You are not allowed to have extras of anything in your locker because of the possibility of abusing other inmates when they need something.
Right.
Over time, a couple of other guys started doing the same thing. And I agreed to keep all the stuff in my locker to protect them. And that's pretty much how our Bible study group began.
Okay.
And then at one point, our Bible study group was meeting 5 nights a week in the library. And the CO said we didn't have to leave for count. They would just count us there.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, that's unusual.
I mean, that is. That's so at 4 o'clock count, you just got to stay right there.
Yeah. At one point, we had one CO who had a reputation for sticking to the rules no matter what. And he tossed my locker. And he said, you got a lot of stuff here. You got socks that are clearly not your size. You got a lot of soap. You know, why are you doing this? So I told him. And he said, all right. And the next week, somebody new came to the unit, and that CO sent the guy to me.
All right.
You know, it's the very basics of, I guess you'd call it, Christian mercy.
No, I agree. And for those who don't realize it, you're absolutely right. I was in several different institutions, and when you first get to an institution or even a county jail, you don't have anything with you. So when you take a shower, for example, you need shower shoes. You don't go in there barefoot because the other men use the restroom in the shower a lot of the time. So you end up with athlete's feet, all these other bad things.
Yep.
So you need to wear shower slippers, these rubber shoes that you just put your feet in, and you wear those to take a shower.
Yep.
You don't have toothpaste. They issue you state toothpaste. They issue state soap, shampoo, luckily, if you can get that. But the thing is those items are horrible. The state toothbrush may last one time before it's just destroyed. So you really need those things, because hygiene behind the fence is extremely important. People don't want you to stink because you're crowded in with each other, and that can cause problems. So hygiene is very important. A lot of the times you get there, and as Tom pointed out, you may be a week or two before you're able to go to commissary to buy these hygiene items. So typically, when I got to all these institutions, someone would come up to you, "Hey, is there something that you need?" Or if you needed something, you would ask, "Hey, does somebody have some extra stuff?" And they would send you to someplace, like you, for example, Utah.
Yep.
They would send you someplace, and you would get the shower shoes, you know, hygiene stuff, things that you need. It's hard to express for someone who hasn't served time. It's hard to express the amount of gratitude that comes from just someone giving you a toothbrush, toothpaste, a bar of soap.
Yep.
You know, because you literally have nothing. Your life after a while becomes whatever is inside of your locker. So when you get there and you don't have anything, just the smallest amount of compassion or assistance, it matters. And this is one of the things that I think people don't understand about prison is it's not, yeah, you can have violence. Certainly I saw a lot of violence, but there are moments of just genuine compassion and humanity that oftentimes you don't see in the free world. And for you to do that, you know, to have that supply of those goods like that, hats off to you on that. Truly, hats off. So that was your federal time, 9 months there. How did it change from the time you first went in to the time when you finally were released? Mindset, stuff like that.
I had started, you know, planning my next life. I had also, unfortunately, talked myself back into falling in love with my ex-wife, thinking that something might happen for us after I got out.
Right.
Because, you know, everybody makes plans in prison. But I was fairly well grounded. I also had a job waiting for me. The factory I was working in when I got locked up said, "We'll see you in 9 months." I didn't have to go to a halfway house.
Okay.
Because the halfway house was 200 miles from home. I had a bank account at home. I had a job and I had a place to live. So I left prison and went back to work the next week.
Outstanding.
I say pretty often, I had it insanely easy.
Right.
The night before I left federal prison, we were sitting around in the Bible group, and one of the kids said, "Have you given any thought as to who's going to take over when you leave?" And I said, "That's not my decision." I said, "Nobody knew I was coming here when Medina left last year. You know, God will provide. Somewhere in New England, maybe right at this moment, a state trooper is telling a minister of the gospel to keep his hands on the car.
Right.
He'll be here." So I was eager to start my life again when I got out. But I also knew that I had that I had disclosed to my client back home that I had stolen from them, and I did not have $6,000 to give to them.
Right.
So I knew something bad was going to happen.
So you get out, and how long is it before you're picked up on the on that charge?
When I wrote to that client, here's how arrogant I was. I wrote to them in the camp. They didn't read your outgoing mail, which is good, because I was disclosing a crime. And I said to them, I will contact you when I get out, but please don't call the cops now. Because if you call the cops, they'll put in a retainer. I'll lose my camp status. I don't want to go up the hill to the prison.
Right.
So they didn't. They said, well, they didn't. They never wrote me back, but they didn't call anybody. And 2 or 3 months went by, and I hadn't called them because I didn't know what to do. And one of them saw me on the street, knew I was out, called the cops. Sheriff came looking for me. And so I made arrangements to meet a local cop at 2 o'clock in the morning when my shift was over at work. He said, did you do it? I was like, well, you have a copy of the letter in front of you.
I said right there, I did it.
Yeah. I never falsely denied a claim by anybody.
Okay.
When I got in trouble in federal prison, they were like, did you do this? I was like, yeah. When the FBI came to my door, did you do it? Yeah. Did you do it to anybody else? No. Yeah. So it's always liberating to be able to say you did it.
Right.
In my state case, the beauty of that case was that our state government had a program where once my client made the complaint, the state advanced to them my restitution. So I owed the state restitution department the money, not my client. They were made whole, at least financially.
Right.
Had I known that, I would have copped to it the day I got out of federal prison. Because I was just happy they were whole. State prison, yeah, there was more violence, different people. In my state camp, I went from being in the camp I was in to teaching 17-year-old kids to read. Yeah. Outside of the lunacy of putting 17-year-old kids in an actual prison,
right?
It was just a very different population. I wasn't the only Eagle Scout in federal camp. I was the only Eagle Scout in my state camp.
Which is, I mean, that's something that that I think a lot of people don't understand either. The clientele, the quality of prisoners in federal prison is far different than it is in state prison. Far different. As you pointed out, in federal prison, you have a much larger demographic of educated individuals that are behind the fence.
Right.
In state prison, you don't.
Absolutely. Largely due to the nature of federal crimes versus state crimes.
Right.
You know, the people involved in serious human trafficking or serious drug trafficking aren't camp eligible.
Right.
So the it's a little distorted there. But yeah, a very, I don't want to say a different class of people, but a different category of people for sure.
So you get to state prison. Who are the inmates that meet you once you get in there?
In state prison, I spent my first 3 nights in a county jail.
Okay.
In an enormous gymnasium with about 200 cots in it. If there was going to be a fight, it was going to be around the corner in the bathroom out of the reach of the cameras.
Right.
For the most part, everybody pretty much left everybody else alone. Partly because they were doing really short, you know, week or two or month or two sentences, or they knew they were on their way somewhere else. I really didn't have a problem in the gym. What worried me was the day I got transferred, I thought I was headed to the camp, which meant I was going to get day for day good time. And instead, they shipped me 50 miles farther north to a medium, an actual prison.
That would be worrying.
I'll tell you what, the prison in Newport, New Hampshire has the most breathtaking view in the fall you could imagine. outdoor rec was I don't want to use this word, but it was glorious. How beautiful it was. But it was a straight up prison. The guy that I worked for in the prison library was a quiet, unassuming, religious guy who had done some incredibly violent things, you know, 20 years ago.
Right.
I rarely felt at risk in the medium, but when they kicked me back to the camp 5 weeks later, I was happy.
I understand that. I do. I understand that.
The odd thing about the state camp is that it was about as secure as a prison. There was an actual fence, which, you know, the federal camp didn't have. But again, it was also a different bunch of guys.
Right. Did you ever? I wanted to ask the question. I figured, you know, thinking through how this show should go. I figured that I would ask the question, and I get this from somebody actually wrote in when I was talking about starting this show, and they were like, hey, don't call it prison politics, call it How I Survived Prison. And I was sitting there thinking, you know, that's a really good title, but I've already got the sign and I like the sign. So I figured that could be one of the questions, you know, how did you survive prison? And it sounds like that you survived prison fairly well, that, you know, you certainly don't strike me as the kind of guy that would go in being loud and obnoxious and not caring about what anyone thought, and you were just going to do whatever you wanted to do.
You know, I've never been in an environment where it was run by the races and the gangs.
Right.
But my experience, yeah, but for the absence of big plastic things and primary colors, federal camp was indistinguishable from daycare.
Okay.
But I learned early on, just be nice.
Right.
Say thank you, say excuse me. You know, easy, easy stuff that goes a long way on the street, but in a pressure cooker environment, goes a really long way.
I mean, it matters. The etiquette matters. Yep. And I've expressed that several times on my other show is, you know, you're so crowded that it's a necessity to be well-mannered. Excuse me, thank you, please, yes, yes or no, sir, everything else. That's just that respect outside of the gate. And it helps to make sure that everything operates properly, because when you are stacked in with each other like sardines, which is often the case,
mm-hmm.
any small thing, like I said, that hygiene problem, you get someone that's dirty, that creates a major issue. It really does. You know, I was in a medium, and you know, people that come in snoring, that doesn't work, because you know, if you come in snoring and no one else can sleep, they'll put up with that maybe two nights.
Yeah.
And you're either going to stop that or something is going to happen. So, you know, it's the whole idea of making sure that you're respectful to each other and you have good manners, that really does make all the difference in the world. Let me ask you, Tom, we're gonna close it out here in just a few minutes. As the show is called Prison Politics, your political opinion of things, pre-prison to post-prison, so before you were incarcerated to after you got out, did your prison experience change your political opinion of, you know, societal issues, things like that at all, or did it remain constant throughout?
My base politics never really wavered.
Okay.
When I looked at the specific politics of prison, especially in today's conversation about defunding this, that, or the other thing, and emptying our prisons,
right,
presumably to make room for paraders, prison was the singular thing that stopped my behavior.
Right.
And the proof is that when I was on probation, and I was at risk for going to prison, I did it again. Prison was the only place where I was removed from the ability to call up a client and lie to him, to fabricate a statement, to transfer money, to do whatever it is I was doing. I had to let all those plates come crashing down, and I couldn't do anything about it. That's the only, whether it was 9 months, 2 years, or 3 months, that had to happen. Nonviolent or not, I belonged in prison.
And I got to be honest with you, you've watched some of my shows. I do a show about the benefits of prison. And you know, at the end of the day, it gets you off the street where you cannot victimize anyone else. It gives you time to think. Because
does it ever?
Because you ain't got nothing else to do. So it gives you time to think. And you know, I saw it time and time again. And you were one of the fortunate ones. That, and yours came much earlier than mine. For me, it took about 2.5 years behind the fence for me to accept that responsibility, for me to understand that who put me behind those bars was me.
Oh, yeah. You know,
and it wasn't because I was trying to support my family or my wife or my stripper girlfriend. It was because I chose to commit crime. I'm not a dumb guy. You're not a dumb guy. We could have easily been very successful in legal careers, yet we chose not to do that. And prison, as you pointed out, prison gets you off the street. You are not going to victimize it. Now, it can happen, but it's much more difficult to victimize people behind that fence than it is in the free world. And for that reason, I mean, there's several different things that go on that are very beneficial in the prison environment. And it sounds like you came to that same conclusion. I've said it before, and you alluded to children being locked up, at those 17-year-olds, and I'm firmly against that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that if you're an adult and you have broken the law, prison can do you a world of good.
Yes.
That's what I think. And it certainly does your victims or potential victims a world of good, because you can no longer victimize those people.
Now, having said that, I alluded earlier to the amount of raw talent in the federal prison.
Right.
I don't know that there's a practical way to make use of that talent. Now, you would think that the Red Cross or the United Way or the Archdiocese of New York, or, you know, pick a charity, pick an organization. There's got to be a way for someone to use some of that talent while, you know, controlling some risk.
Let's be honest. You've got, and hey, grant you, the talent that's behind those federal fences is extraordinary. It is. But it's talent that's laced with problems with authority.
Well, there's that.
And I agree with you. I mean, how do you harness that? It's difficult, to say the least. You know, I know what you do for a living these days, and you're very successful, and I have nothing, truthfully, I have nothing but the utmost respect for the way that you lead your life, and the way that the honesty and just outright humbleness that you have when you talk about these things. I mean, it's something that I strive for every single day. I have nothing but respect for you on that.
Well, I appreciate that, Brett.
And I mean that. I'm not jerking your chain. I mean that. You know, the thing is men that are behind the fence, I don't know how, you said it too, I don't know how you would ever put a lot of that to good. And at the same time, even if it is federal prison, I mean, federal prison is not about rehab. It's very difficult to get in a lot of these programs. They stop the college educations. You have to pay out of pocket a lot of the time. So you've got a lot of inmates that are highly skilled, highly talented, and they leave prison with the exact same tools they go into prison with. And that becomes a problem.
The guys that hung around in the library in our spare time, and especially in the federal camp, people would kind of cycle in and out.
Yeah. Right.
What do I do about this business problem? How do I start a business? What do you guys know?
Right.
As often as not, it was one of the COs, because they knew the value of the talent too. We actually formed a group to, do an exercise in starting a business to help other guys understand what it took, everything starting with your choice of entity all the way to why do you want to do this? Is it going to be profitable?
Right.
Partly out of sheer boredom, but partly because there was this need to share the information, to share the experience.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, right? I mean, a lot of people that, even people who've never been to prison, and those who have, a lot of people don't understand that if you are going to be successful when you get out, you probably are not going to work for someone. You need to be able to start your own business and be your own boss on things, especially those federal people that have those problems with authority.
Right.
That's a lot of the reason that I do what I do. I was in the corporate world last year. Mm-hmm. I got to be honest with you. I am the happiest man in the world to no longer be in the corporate world. I don't like having to answer to people. I like being able to do my own thing, to say what I want to say. So, and I'm very happy. I took one massive pay cut, but I am very happy not being in the corporate world anymore because of that.
You know, I'm not in the corporate world now, but I have a factory job that has me from Wednesday afternoon pretty much till Saturday night.
Okay.
It's highly physical. It's always hot. It's not a job for a guy my age.
No, I agree.
But it is the best job I've ever had.
How long have you had that job, Tom?
Since November.
You go to church every Sunday, Wednesday too, or not?
Most Sundays.
Okay.
But this job, it provides a cornerstone for our schedule so that I'm not floundering, because I'm not a good manager of my own time.
Right.
But for the first time in my life, my wages are supporting the whole household.
I mean, that's got to be a very,
that's a new thing for me. Unfortunately, it's also a new thing for my wife,
right.
But we're now, so yes, I can pursue the teaching and sharing I do, and the writing I do. But that job affords me, aside from the wage and the health insurance, a sense of value I never knew before.
I mean, I get that. I do. My value comes from, a lot of my value comes from being the guy. And I think everyone kind of knows that these days because I say it enough, but I'm the guy that says the stuff nobody else will say, much a lot of the time to the detriment of my bottom line. But I'm still the guy that's going to say that stuff. I mean, my a lot of my value when I was a criminal was the way that I was viewed by my criminal peers. You know, that respect that was given.
A higher level of a lower class.
That's it. That's it. And these days, my sister made this comment of, I just don't know how to do anything in moderation. When I was a criminal, I was on top of the heap. And now that I'm the good guy, I'm not bad. But it's that, I think you're right. I mean, it's, where do you find that value in life, that reward? And again, for you, I've got nothing but just the utmost respect for the way you carry your life, your person, everything that you do. If people want to contact you, Tom, to talk about your journey, have you come in and speak, maybe write a blog, anything else like that, how would they contact you?
I've been keeping up my blog a lot more frequently than I had been, once, twice a week, and I'm working on doing it more. My website is fraudspeaker.net. My Twitter handle is @formercriminal.
I like the handle.
And my email address is tom@hireathief.com.
I should have had that one.
Now, I said earlier, I say thief because there was nothing sophisticated about what I did.
Right.
And in the organizations I talked to, that's what you're protecting against. You're not protecting against, public company financial statement fraud.
Absolutely.
You're protecting against somebody who's going to write a check to themselves.
Absolutely.
Kids, ask your parents about checks.
Yeah, and checks are very, I mean, on the cybercrime side, checks are going crazy right now. Tom Hughes, fraudspeaker.net. Anyone who's listening to the show, if you would like a speaker to come in who is very humble, very truthful, and talks about his journey from that dark side to come into the light and the good that he's trying to do now, I don't think that you could do better than Tom Hughes. So please reach out to him. I think that he's an extraordinary man. He's a good guy as well. He truly is. Tom, if you don't mind, I'd like to see if you'd like to come back sometime. This show, like I said, I'm just trying right now to figure out what it is. I want it to be the show where we're talking about, you know, at least at some level, I want it to be the show where we're talking about some of the societal stuff too.
But absolutely,
because not every show like that.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm happy. You found someone just narcissistic enough to talk about himself all the time,
which is not a bad thing because I'm like that too.
By all means, I'll see you soon.
No, Tom, I appreciate you coming on. Stay safe and Godspeed, my friend.
God bless you, Brett.
All right. So that was episode number 72 of the Brett Johnson Show, a prison politics test pilot. Hey, look, I want to thank you guys for taking the time to tune in and listen to the show. I truly do appreciate it. Leave me a comment. Let me know what you like, what you don't like about the show. Better yet, subscribe. Don't care what platform you listen to it on. If you listen to Spotify, YouTube, iTunes, whatever. If you're able to subscribe, please subscribe whether you like the show or not. Hopefully the show will continue to get better. Let me know what you think worked and didn't work. And without further ado, we're going to close this thing out the same way we close out the Brett Johnson Show every single time. How do we do that? We start by saying, hey, stay safe, stay secure, stay vigilant. More importantly, understand that this is the Brett Johnson Show. At the end of the day, just do the right damn thing. I'm Brett Johnson. I want to thank you for taking the time to tune in. Until next time, take care.